Now, as we wade through the ponderous tomes of the Old Testament, we have to keep our sights established. Going from week to week, it's a little difficult to do that, especially when we take chunks here and there. We're trying to weave those things together, because in the end, as I've said so often, what we want is not to be knowledgeable or scholars about the Old Testament or the Bible, but to have some grasp of what it means to live in this world. A great many people just go from day to day living with cliches and tired and old religious ideologies that don't work anyway. But, you know, it's a nice, comfortable feeling to have a few tenets around, doctrines or dogmas that you can cling to. It's a tough thing grappling with life at the really gut level. And it's one thing for people in an ivory tower to throw out all these lovely promises and so forth about what God does or should do or doesn't do or whatever. But when you have to face the people for whom these things don't work, that's the problem, you know. That is, when you have to try to justify God's actions in their lives or his lack of action in their lives. It's so easy for the pulpit to say, oh yes, just bring your problem to Jesus, he'll solve everything. But I have to live with the people that don't get their problems solved, and that's not so easy. Of course, again, it's easy for me to cop out on the basis of, well, you just haven't got enough faith, or you're not doing the right things, or you're not good enough, or whatever. But I wouldn't do that. You know, I have to face it realistically. And I think that whatever it is that God does for people, everyone has a right to expect him to do it for them. Reviewing these characters of the Bible, I'm more and more impressed with the fact that they didn't have a whole lot of great things done for them either. I remember the basic thesis, which you've got to get hold of, fundamental thesis here, is that God exists whether we like him or not, or whether we like what he does or not, or whether we understand it or not. He still exists. To say, well, I'm not going to be a Christian because God's let me down, you know, is dumb. Because either God is or he isn't. Whether you like what he does or don't like what he does is beside the point. Yes, it'd be nice if he'd solve things, and maybe there are a lot of intricacies to life where we may have had a hand in causing some problems for ourselves. But generally speaking, we get a hand dealt to us and we live it out the best of our ability. And we louse up a few things here and there and suffer a little more. But by and large, we're like everybody else in the world. It's patently true that everybody has some kind of problem. Sooner or later, you run into your snags, whoever you are. And life doesn't always go well. But that's no reason to discontinue believing in God. It may be a very good reason to give up some of the fairy tale notions, or the Alice in Wonderland concepts about God. I talked to a person not long ago who was very upset with God because he hadn't done this and this and this. So this person was telling me all about what they thought God was, and they didn't like that kind of situation. I said, well, I never taught that kind of stuff. Maybe if you'd come around and listen, you know, you might learn some things about God. But I said, you can't just go snatching verses here and there from the Bible and put together any kind of a meaningful concept of who God is. And of course that's fostered by countless teachers and evangelists, so-called, radio people, television people, and so forth, who foster the idea that this is the way God is, that he just comes into our life and brings the sunshine and solves all the problems and washes the posies with the raindrops, you know, and it's a lovely life. If you've got enough faith, that's always the joker in the deck. But who has enough faith to get all of that stuff? Then, of course, here and there, miracles happen. I mean, things happen that are remarkable, and usually when the Lord has to bail us out, it's because we're too chicken to go on. we scream and squeal, and he has to let up the heat a little bit and give us a little break, and then we get revived and we go on. But I've said with John and Paul in the commentary, I spoke of this. I was talking about John the Baptist, who was dealt a pretty dirty hand by that little trollop who danced before the king. He was dealt a pretty bad hand there. You know, as I looked at that and I looked at Paul, who after a lifetime or after a number of years of very, very heavy service and substantial suffering, at the last there, instead of being carried to the skies on flowery beds of ease, his ultimate reward was getting his head chopped off, you know, and that there'd be many people that would feel God hadn't given him a very good hand with that. You'd think at the end of his life, the Lord would kind of make things a little nicer for him so he could have a little relief and reprieve. Because he had a tough life. It, you know, it wasn't so much that he cared about the circumstances, but the heart problem. You know, that is pouring himself out for the people and being rejected and being kicked around and so forth was not easy. He didn't mind the hardships. It was the care that he had of the churches, the inner relationship, that is the inner feelings in terms of his relationship. You just can't really help people unless you care for them, and you can't care for them without getting shafted. If you don't care a hoot about anybody, if everybody's just a digit or on the computer or a postcard or something, it's not too difficult to carry on a ministry where you never see any faces, just postcards. And a lot of these operators wouldn't have time to read the mail anyway. You know, in some of these big operations, they're covering a few hundred thousand people. They don't have time to see the mail. Other people read it in the office and send the appropriate computerized reply, and that's all there is to it. But when the people you deal with are faces, it's tough. And Paul went through all of that, and he mentions a lot of it in his letters. Went through a lot of distress and despair and so forth. Well, his reward for that in the end was get his head chopped off. That doesn't seem like a very good thing for God to do to the fellow. But I have to, you know, go down the road of not letting you get involved in fairy tales. The Old Testament is not God's version of Grimm's fairy tales. People like Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Moses, these are real people, but they were not storybook types, only insofar as they have their Sunday school versions. Then they become storybook types. And Moses has this glorious, according to the Sunday school program, of course in the Bible storybooks, Moses has this glorious life raised in the Pharaoh's palace, and then he goes out and has a lovely time herding sheep, and and then he comes back and he does all these great miracles. Well, that's really rather a distortion of what it was really like. He had to flee for his life from the Pharaoh because of his involvement with the people out there in Goshen. And as I've said before, herding sheep for 40 years on the back of the desert, out in the wilderness of Sinai, shouldn't be depicted with woolly little lambs and palm trees and Moses sitting by a brook with his staff, you know. That's not the way it was. The nomad's life was a tough life. And he had it for 40 years. Some of the parents get very nervous if their young people aren't going through college and making a great name for themselves. They'd have been very upset with Moses. Sitting out there in the desert with a few sheep. And they say, "What did we put you through school? This is why we put you through school. You got herd a few sheep." The way it gets portrayed in these Bible story books and on the flannel graphs and everything is a little bit too much fairyland, you see. So what we want to do with you is help you come to grips with life as it is. then you can handle it. You can handle it, right? But the main thing is, I don't make any guarantees. I know that, and I've always given you assurance that your spirit's going to be all right. And that's what it's all about, after all. And like I said, this article in a Times paper that, where these theologians got together and decided that they didn't want to fault God for not taking care of the evil of the world, so they found a way around it by saying God is really nice and he really loves us all, but he just hasn't got the power to give everybody a nice life. But you can't fault him for that, so we'll just regard him as our kindly grandfather who loves us, and we'll not fault him for letting the world go sour, because he just simply hasn't got the power to help it. Now, that's just idiocy of the first rank, and it's very rank, in fact. But it's born out of this whole idea that what God is really good for is to make a nice world and then take us to a nice little heaven. Because this is the way a great percentage of the church today operates. To get a good life on the earth and to make everybody happy and feed everybody and make it a nice world for everybody. Undocumented aliens get their proper share of the welfare, and to see that everything is running according to the principles of brotherly love, and that it's a good world. We're out to make a good world for everybody. So they carry placards and they send money to the rebels in Africa. And they do all these things to help make it a nice world everywhere. See? That's why they're missing it with God. That's why they don't understand God, because they can't understand why God hasn't been in the vanguard of feeding the rebels in Africa. See, they feel God ought to be out there in the front line trenches feeding the world. But you see, God's purpose is to let us all see that this world is an evil place, that it is rotten, that there are problems down here, but that he's trying to show us not to put our attention on the physical. That is to say, not to let that be the guide, the gauge or guide of our lives. Whatever goes on in this physical world is part of the circumstances, part of the mold, part of the vessel. The real thing is the spirit. That's what's going on. And God would not be true to himself if he so patched up the vessel that the spirit didn't get attention. If he made everything so nice for everybody that they would never be forced to the conclusion that there's nothing for them in this world and that they ought to focus their attention on the spirit. So we start with the premise, which we get from the Bible, that God is. He exists. Whether we like him or not, whether we like the way he functions or not, he exists, irrespective of our own attitudes toward him. The second point is that God has a fundamental purpose for life, but his purpose is not particularly tied up in this world. His purpose is tied up not in the material world, but in the spirit world. Now you see, along the way, there are things in the material world that have to be fulfilled. God has his finger in the course of history, very deeply. And things have gone his way in the course of the world. And I've said to you before, it's a remarkable thing that here in the 20th century, out here at the farthest most reaches of the Western Hemisphere, the gospel has come to us. Having started back there in that little dusty province arena of Palestine. Not only the farthest reaches of the Western Hemisphere, but also the farthest reaches of the Asian coast. China, Korea, Kamchatka, Vladivostok. They're out to the easternmost reaches of the Asiatic continent, the Eurasian continent. The Word of God is gone. And starting from that very simple little village or town in Palestine, because at the time the message sort of exploded in Jerusalem, the day of Pentecost took place in Jerusalem. Jerusalem was not then what it is today. Jerusalem was more like beautiful downtown Burbank, but it wasn't quite as beautiful. If you see the walls of the old city of Jerusalem, they're not very large. You can walk across the thing in 15 minutes. That's how big it was when Jesus was there. And from that little town in a little country, the gospel has spread all of this way. Now, sometimes God used circumstances specifically, and sometimes he did it in spite of the circumstances. He allowed this and that ruler to reign in the world and have a regime. I presume he allowed Napoleon. Do you know, if it hadn't been for Napoleon, we wouldn't be sitting here today? Do you know that? Now, what does Napoleon Bonaparte have to do with this Bible class in beautiful downtown Sunland? Well, he has a great deal to do with it. Napoleon was the son of a very modestly successful advocate, counselor in the island of Corsica, if I recall, off the coast of Italy. So it was a very humble beginning. It wasn't like a Wall Street corporation lawyer attorney. It was just a simple counselor. But anyway, Napoleon nevertheless was trained in a military academy and did very, very well, and rose rather rapidly in the ranks. But became quite an accomplished general, although he went down into Egypt and lost the war down there, just completely blew it all, left most of his men down there, but he came back to Paris with the announcement that he'd been tremendously successful down there. But of course, you didn't have television coverage in those days, you know. So nobody really found out. But he worked his way into the leadership of the people of France. And finally, France was in a very disrupted state at that time. We're talking now about the early 19th century, 1800s, and the latter part of the 18th century, right after the French Revolution. That was 17... what? Remember? The fall of the Bastille. What's the date? July 14th, 1789 is when the Bastille fell. There were only 17 prisoners in the Bastille, but nobody knew that. They thought the thing was filled with political prisoners, that they were going to release half the population of Paris out of the Bastille, but only 17 people and a couple of dozen rats, I guess, is all that was left there. So, all right, now, emerging out of this revolution came a constitutional monarchy in France, which was presided over by a consul, sort of like a council of elders. They beheaded Louis XIV and Marie Antoinette, his dingy queen. And after that, the country went through a series of poor governmental processes. And so comes now Napoleon, and he walked into this council of elders, with his sword and forcefully routed the leaders. And he and his people took over, and he became consul general or military consul of France in that stroke. And he said, I found the crown of France lying on the ground, and I picked it up with a sword. By which he meant there was no one leading France at that time, no one with any dynamic leadership at that time. So he stepped in and took over. Well, the fascinating thing about human nature is that 10 years after the blood had run knee-deep in the streets of Paris, getting rid of a king, the people, by plebiscite vote, which means a vote of the common people, of all the people, by plebiscite, voted to make him emperor. After they'd spent all this effort, blood and effort getting rid of a king, now they put him in as an emperor. That speaks both for the idiocy of the people and the dynamism of the man. He was a very good ruler for them, of course. Now, he had his sights set on the world. I presume that if Napoleon had tended to the business of just running France, he'd have done an excellent job because he established the Bank of France, put the financial status of the empire on a solid footing, restored a lot of the order to the thing, established an excellent school system, did very many fine things for France. But then he had this world avarice, who wanted to be a conquer the world. So he set out to do that and bled the people dry trying to make these campaigns. All right, now, the reason for all of this whole thing is, in the course of the Napoleonic conquest through various land grabs and trades and so forth, France had title to all the property which we call the Louisiana Purchase. The Louisiana Purchase was a territory that you could best describe as follows. If you would think in terms of a large balloon, and you'd start at the mouth of the Mississippi River at New Orleans, and you would go up the Mississippi, and then in the great balloon take in the northern part of the continent of America, clear over to the Pacific coast, come back down to the Mississippi again. That is the area known as the Louisiana Territory. Now that was held by Napoleon. So the Emperor of France, with designs on the world, had the lands and had title to or possession of the city of New Orleans at the mouth of the Mississippi, which controlled the heartland of America. All of our trade from the heartland of America had to go down through that port of New Orleans. So virtually, here is a man who has world conquest in his mind, virtually controlling the fortunes of the young American continent. He was at a point in his campaigns desperate for money. And Jefferson seized the opportunity, sent an emissary over to France to negotiate with Napoleon for the acquiring of this territory. The Congress authorized these representatives to pay $2 million for it, a fairly good figure for that amount of land. Jefferson called his own emissary in, who was not an official ambassador, but he was a private emissary of Jefferson, and he confidentially said, look, Congress said $2 million. I'm going to authorize you to go to $10 million. But don't tell anybody. Just keep your counsel to yourself. Don't even tell this ambassador that's going with you. So he went over there, and in some pretty hard negotiations, they settled for $10 million. However, by the time they got through with the settlements that Napoleon wanted, it really amounted to about $15 million. So this fellow coming back felt that when he got here, he'd be sacked for sure for going there. But he didn't. He had the authority to do it, and he negotiated and took the Louisiana Territory for $15 million. Jefferson sent out the famous Lewis and Clark expedition, to whom we owe our fortunes as well, because by their explorations and claiming the land and making their report and so forth, we suddenly were catapulted from a territory that was stopped at the Mississippi River. Suddenly we were catapulted into a territory that spanned the whole continent. You know, once you get started on a thing like that, there's no stopping point. Anyway, the point about it is that we were from that point on catapulted into almost what we would call an exponential increase of needs and demand, supply and demand process, which finally eventuated in our being inevitably pressed into becoming an industrial power, which we became after the Civil War. But the development and expansion of that territory, the moment we began to explore it, the development and expansion came rather rapidly, and so we wound up finally developing everything clear to the Pacific Ocean. It had not been for that Louisiana Purchase, we'd probably still been in the Mississippi River, running steamboats up and down there. I'd probably be Mississippi River gambler today. You know? We'd have stayed probably east of the Mississippi, but that gave us this one great thrust that we needed. Now I give you that for this reason. It would be totally absurd to say that God's hand was not in the history of the world. He has many, many times intervened. Now, to say, on the other hand, that God is totally responsible for everything that happens in the world is equally absurd. The degree to which God might be responsible for the machinations of Hitler, you see, would be another question altogether. Certainly, Hitler went far beyond whatever might have been original destiny, if you will, development and expansion. God's hand is in the fortunes of the world, as he was in the fortunes of Israel. It was not by accident that Moses finally was catapulted into a position of power there in, among his people in Egypt. It was not even by accident he was exiled to the backside of the desert. But God uses movements. He uses nations and people to further his cause or to fulfill his purpose on the earth. I suspect that many things are just fallout stuff, things that happen as a secondary result of primary activity. But the net result of whatever it is that God has done is that the message pertaining to the spirits has passed from that distant province clear to the western reaches of the Western Hemisphere, the Pacific Coast. And we sit here tonight talking about the matters of the spirits as though we were in our right minds. No, we really are in our right minds. This is the way that we have come to understand things of the Spirit. So you have to say God has done a remarkable job. He wants us to know that the important thing is the Spirit. And any choice that limits the Spirit and focuses on the flesh is a poor choice. Once we get hold of that, we're in better shape. Someone said to me, discussing my own situation, I've known this person for quite great many years, and we were talking about our various fortunes, that is, I don't have a fortune. I'm talking about a lot, our fortunes. But he was saying to me, well, one ace you have in the matter is that you don't really want much. I've been able to carry this work on because I haven't had very grandiose desires or ambitions. But that is something, you see, that's something that I've had to come to by understanding the spirits. This person said he's got money in a number of bank accounts. He doesn't even know what to do with it. He doesn't know how much he's got. He's got everything he wants. His life doesn't count for much in the spirit realm, see? But, you know, as I had to say to him, like, you know, it's a choice one makes recognizing the spirit world that that's the valuable thing. And that's what all these men of God throughout the Bible found out. I'm not putting myself in their category. I'm saying that's what they found. The great secret that these men discovered was that God is concerned about the spirit realm, and that's where it's at. And he's not so concerned about the material thing. He never really felt, as I could see it, all that concerned to see that his prophets had comfort. It was not his primary concern point. He didn't always treat them that well. But what he did treat them to was insight into the thing that matters. If you had the choice between a relative, an uncle, let us say, that was able to leave you a fortune in material goods, versus an uncle, we keep talking about the rich uncle, that's why I use the word uncle, versus an uncle who had great wisdom about life and was able to leave you a heritage of understanding and wisdom about how to live, you'd be far better off with the latter than the former. I'm not going to ask you which you'd take. You know, we hear it all the time, and we see evidences of it. It's very hard to believe that money can't buy happiness. Someone has said money isn't everything, but it's way ahead of whatever second. But that's sort of a funny thing. It's not a true. Don't buy that. We all are so well aware of the tragedies of the people who have so much one day and so little the next. Anyone can tell you that no matter how much money you have, it doesn't cover heartache, for example. Parents who've given their children everything that money can buy, but nothing for their spirits, go through a lot of hell trying to recover something of these young people's lives when they go off the deep end. And of course, we're all aware of the lives of the personalities, the prominent ones around us here in our area or in the show business and so forth, and tragedies that stalk their paths. But just remember, you're so rich if you have developed and are developing your spirit facet. That is, I'm not saying to become religious. I'm not asking you to do religious things. I'm just saying to recognize your tie to Christ. Recognize that that's the important thing. And don't worry if you've got trouble in the flesh or you have as much as you'd like to have of this world's goods, or you've got problems and troubles and everything. Don't leave Christ over that. Stay with him, because he's, through these things, he's helping you to grow so you can cope. You can cope with things. Someone I'm talking to that never get to the meetings, and they're trying to figure their own ideas out about God. And I said, you're just not getting any input. See? You're never going to come to anything just getting out of your own head these things. You've got to have input. And you've got to have spiritual nourishment. As I've said to parents about their children, these little kids, you don't think they're getting anything, maybe, but I said, when they come to a meeting like this, the Spirit nourishes their spirits in the meeting. They don't have to understand the things I say. The Spirit of God is here. He nourishes them, just like when you take, if you take the kid out into the fresh air, you say, well, I'm going to take Junior for a walk today in the fresh air, because he needs fresh air. And somebody would say, look, come on, don't take the kid out in the fresh air. He hasn't had a single course in physics that I know of, or in biology, or any of the sciences. How does he know what air is all about? It doesn't make any difference. Well, he knows he's going out into the air, and he's going to absorb something of that value, whether he understands it or not. But the Spirit nourishes anyway. You're being exposed to nourishment in the Spirit. So what that means in developing our spirits is, A, exposing ourselves to nourishment. Not necessarily just reading the Bible for ourselves. It's a good thing to read the Bible, but it also can be a problem. People read verses that they don't understand. They get all shook up about it because they got a wrong meaning to it. Now remember, I don't say don't read the Bible. I'm just saying that's not the ultimate way of nourishment. Get the Word of God from a good source, in addition to the Bible, to reading it, but also just communicating with Christ, prayer, which is just communication. I don't mean just having daily prayer sessions at 5 in the morning or 6 in the evening or whatever. I just mean being in communication with Christ through the day, just like you would with a partner, an associate. Just talk to him. So that's part of your spiritual nourishment, you see. And then face your circumstances in the name of Christ. Don't just run out and do things on your own, ignoring Christ. That was is the prime example of focusing on the flesh, is going out on your own to live your life without giving attention to what Christ wants. And that it does not help the spirit to charge out in the flesh and do things apart from Christ. That doesn't mean everything you do has to be religious. I just mean that you ought to be sensitive to what He wants in your life. And no matter how great the alternatives look, remember that this whole fleshly world is subject to total collapse. Individual lives collapse and nations collapse. So the only assurance I can give anybody is that if they focus on Christ and tend to their spirit, that He'll keep them strong in spirit. And that's what He's developing. The other doesn't amount to hell beans. Well, I think we better stop here.